Welcome, welcome once again to Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific, brought to you by IEJ Media, our producer, and Bauer Group Asia, our sponsor. I'm Ray Powell, the former military officer. That's Jim Caruso, the former diplomat. Jim, how are you?
Well, the cactus is blooming. It must be spring.
In Arizona, we should mention, which is why he has cacti. We have another former military officer with us today. It's Tom Shugart. He is a defense expert. He is a former U.S. Navy submarine warfare officer. He has over 25 years of service. He now is an adjunct senior fellow at the Center for New American Security, and he focuses on undersea warfare, maritime competition, military innovation, and the like. Tom, how are you?
Doing great. It is a beautiful spring day here in the Washington, D.C. area. And so I busted out the Aloha shirt in honor of some lovely weather. I do have some island time in my career. I spent 3 years in the islands, so I feel like I have the right to wear one from time to time. So there we go. It's all good.
Our audio listeners will appreciate hearing about your Aloha shirt. Our YouTube watchers will have already noticed it. But I have a question for you about a different island, and that would be the island of Taiwan. And recently, there has been quite a bit of commotion in the Taiwan watching community about these barges that have shown up on satellite imagery and even some photographs that look like they are designed to essentially facilitate an invasion. And they've been sort of dubbed China's invasion barges. Tom Shugart, why should we care about these?
Well, I think the reason that we should care about these in particular is that, I mean, one of the most important questions I think you can ask in the defense space these days in terms of the U.S.-China military competition is, does China have the ability to invade Taiwan? Do they have the physical ability to do so? And in the absence of civilian shipping, if you just count up the number of gray-painted PLA Navy amphibious assault ships, the answer is pretty easy. It's no, they don't have enough sea lift to be able to invade Taiwan. However, if you integrate China's by far the world's largest shipbuilding nation, the world's largest merchant marine now. If you integrate China's immense civilian shipping sector, the answer goes from no to maybe. But the key is the ability to get this immense capacity in sea lift to be able to transfer the units and forces carried by those vessels ashore. Now, we've seen some significant movement on this front in recent years. I was sure it got my attention and inspired a couple of articles that I've written, in addition to a lot of other work done by folks like Michael Dahl and Connor Kennedy. And quite frankly, they did a lot of this work before I did. If you look at the scale of the China seaplane shipping, and one of the key things that's happened in recent years is that this has gone from a theoretical thing to something they're practicing doing on a routine basis. Specifically, we now see in the recent years, Chinese ferries that have been modified to launch amphibious assault vehicles straight off the back of the ferries and directly to the beach. So this is a significant additional capacity where now these civilian ferries, and people should understand when I talk about these ferries, they're much larger than anything you would have seen in the United States. They are built to national defense standards. They can carry tanks, armored vehicles. But in the case of these ferries, they've been limited in terms of the first echelon assault to just what they can send ashore that can swim, that's actually amphibious. Other than that, delivery of heavier vehicles and also delivery via China's large number of very substantial and large vehicle carriers, not ferries, but vehicle carriers, would require the use of either a temporary port or a Taiwanese port that's been captured. So this new system potentially is a really interesting new way that they could leverage that immense civilian shipping capacity to be able to carry forces to Taiwan.
So let's describe a little bit what these new barges are. So basically they're jack-up barges. So they go to a fairly shallow part of the area around the country of interest. They jack themselves down, having a stable platform. They can go back-to-back, so almost forming a bridge, is my understanding. And that way they can offload large amounts of equipment and troops. Does anyone else have this capacity? Any other military in your knowledge?
I don't know of anybody else that has anything quite like this. I mean, it was quite surprising to see how these things have been assembled together. So HI Sutton is the guy that that I, as far as I know, first found these in imagery. I published an article in January. I had seen these in imagery of the GSI Longshui shipyard, but had not recognized what they were. I thought they were just, you know, some sort of oil rig platform or something. You know, I didn't think much of them. He was the first one to point out that these are roadways, that these are, these appear to be, they have these jack up bar, you know, legs and whatnot. He's the guy that identified what these things really could be. What's interesting about how they and how they operate and how it's different is I think a lot of folks, more folks than used to be, are now familiar with the U.S. Army's JLOTS, Joint Logistics Over the Shore System, because of, unfortunately, of its challenges in conducting the Gaza pier resupply operation last year, where they had a lot of difficulties with weather. It took a long time to get there. I think it took a fair bit of time to set up. So what a lot of people thought was going to be an easy operation turned out to be quite difficult. This is a bit different than that in the sense that, as you mentioned, James, if you look at the way these things operate, it appears that what they do is they go right up on the shore. And I mean right up on the shore. So I've done some work to actually look at the satellite imagery of these things, match it precisely with the digital nautical charts. And the smallest of these actually crosses into the intertidal zone. Like it actually goes past zero depth on the chart. So they go right up on the pier, probably a high tide. They go well up onto the beach. And then they've lowered those legs and firmly implant themselves. And they actually lift themselves up out of the water. The body of the barge comes up out of the water. So now instead of a floating pier like we saw off of Gaza, this thing is mounted in, you know, is firmly mounted in the on the bottom and has lifted itself up out of the water. Then the real surprise here was when we saw these in imagery, we saw three different types: 4-leg, 6-leg, 8-leg, of variously 110 meters, 135 meters, and 185 meters in length. I thought, well, these are just three different flavors. Maybe they use them for different beach types, just different lengths. Maybe they're trying out three different kinds. The real shocker was in the video that we saw that came out recently from China, where, yeah, as you said, James, the three of them are connected together. So that instead of one, say, 300 meter long pier, you have an 850 meter long pier. Then these are like a matched set, like Russian dolls that go together.
So if you're Taiwan and you're looking at this, how does the existence of this new capability change your strategic calculus when you're thinking about how you need to be prepared for the potential of an invasion?
I mean, as I've said publicly, this development, I think, should be making hair stand on end in Taipei and in Washington. I mean, if I'm looking at, you know, we now know that our intelligence community has said, leaders of the IC have said out loud that, you know, Xi Jinping has directed the PLA to be ready to invade Taiwan by 2027. This is the kind of thing you do to be ready to invade Taiwan by 2027, in my opinion. You know, to be able to leverage that civilian shipping on a time, it makes sense for that timeline. So let's say that's your plan, 2027. Okay, so you build these things, you try them out in 2025. Imagine what we'll see. We have not yet seen them actually docking within ships, but I imagine this summer we'll see them take part in the usual landing exercises that the PLA does. They'll probably test them out, run them out, maybe make some adjustments, build some more over the fall and winter of the next year, try some more the next year, and then build enough to be ready to go in 2027. It kind of makes sense for that timeline to need it, conceivably. So I think it's an indication that they are deadly serious about being able to do that in 2027. And I think that Taiwan should take action accordingly, as if they're under mortal threat.
So I imagine these things don't move real fast. I know I probably aren't that maneuverable. Are there other vulnerabilities that you would foresee?
You know, in terms of maneuverability, I mean, so I watched these things, as far as I could, I watched these things get sent downriver from the shipyard. So what's interesting is, I literally went and watched AIS footage for the shipyard, you know, weeks at a time with AIS footage to try to find when these things left the shipyard. So we had imagery where they were there and then imagery where they were gone. And that was the big surprise. Oh my goodness, they've left the shipyard. So now let's go back and see if we can find if they have an AIS transmission and what they're called.
Sorry. And AIS is the automatic information system that ships broadcast to identify themselves.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, so it's and normally commercial ships use AIS to broadcast their position, location, destination, course, speed, name, etc. PLA Navy ships basically never transmit AIS. U.S. Navy ships sometimes do, depending on the situation, in order to help ensure and to help improve navigational safety. In any case, I watched and you could see most of the ships that are getting underway from the shipyard. You could see the tugs and you could see them grab onto the commercial ship, take it out on the river and send it down the river. These, you could clearly see from where we had seen them on imagery, the tugs going in pairs and got through three tugs at a time, grab these things, take them out, take them down the river, let them go and then follow them. And these are self-propelled vehicles. I mean, because you can see the tugs letting go. So these are self-propelled barges. And I thought that was likely just based on seeing on imagery. They have dual radars, dual pilot houses. They have engines, exhausts. So I saw the scenes that run like 10 to 12 knots of the tugs that were following these things along. So it got to swimming speed as an LST, an amphibious assault vehicle. They're relatively slow compared to like warships. But they're not super slow. They can get across, and you figure that they could cross the strait in about 12 hours. I could tell you also that we have seen in imagery now where they're assembled in one image and then 4 hours later they're gone. So it looks like they could be taken down in a matter of hours, not a matter of days, as may be the case with traditional floating piers.
So the U.S. strategy has been enunciated in one way by Admiral Stan Paparo from U.S. Indo-PACOM, talking about turning the Taiwan Strait into an unmanned hellscape, he called it. Do you think that this is sort of, is this the way to sort of hold off China's confidence about an invasion or the potential for invasion, or hold off an actual invasion? Or do you agree that this is the best chance to sort of stave off an invasion?
So I don't really know what unfortunately, there is very little detail about what this hellscape is about in terms of the specifics and what exact kind of drones are we talking about? Are they out there? What's their range? What are their sensor capabilities? What are their warheads? So it's really difficult to, pass judgment on or have confidence in, for that matter, exactly what the plan is in terms of this hellscape thing, because I mean, let's face it, there are a lot of limitations with drones when it comes to open ocean warfare. They typically, people are very excited about the things they've seen in Ukraine, but you have to remember what Ukraine is. 99% of the drones you see in Ukraine are quadcopters that have a range of about 20 kilometers, generally limited by their ability to control them by line of sight communications. That's the 12-mile line at sea. That's not very far. So where I think drones can have an impact, we have to remember that at sea, we've dealt with drones for quite some time. They're called anti-ship cruise missiles and homing torpedoes. I mean, they're not as new at sea as they are in other places, certainly at open ocean, at longer distances. So, the way I recommended for years and, in testimony a few years ago, and I maintain that to this day, is there needs to be a lot of survivable anti-ship cruise missiles, smart mines, runway independent drones that don't need runways to operate, because the Chinese are going to crater those first thing. Whatever we have needs to be not dependent upon continuous communication, which is a problem, may potentially be a problem with respect to policy on lethal unmanned systems that may require a human to be monitoring. Well, if the Chinese cut the communications, and that's kind of step one of their system destruction warfare idea, then that may not be as easy. I like to say oftentimes there are no magic beans. There's no magic beans. You have to apply resources to do this, to defend against a threat the scale of China. And I mean, it sounds great, but we just don't know enough specifics at this point. On the mining point, I think mine warfare is a fantastic way to go. Unfortunately, I don't think the mines are laid right now. China or Taiwan has invested in mine laying ships and mine laying capabilities. But the thing I'd like to say to anybody who will listen is those minefields have to be laid now, because if China has made the decision to invade Taiwan, they are not going to watch Taiwan lay the minefields that are going to stop them. It's not like, you know, like China has any respect for Taiwan's territorial integrity or their territorial seas. They're not going to watch them lay those minefields. So that kind of thing needs to happen now. Unfortunately, these platforms may make it much harder to know where to buy, because one of the things that a lot of observers have taken for granted for some time is that there's a relatively small number of beaches that China could invade in terms of the bottom contour, exits from the beaches. And these things potentially could open up a lot of new places where they could come ashore, maybe not even a beach. You know, if you have, for example, these 140 meter long ramps, if you could put them over a seawall onto a coastal road, or go up to a port from the outside of the port, if the channel's been blocked, and lay them down on top of the wall of a port, like a Kaohsiung or Taichung, there's a lot of new places that potentially that could be vulnerable. So it may make that whole minefield thing harder to do. And, you know, in short, there's no easy answers.
All right. So do you think China wanted us all to know about these things and their capabilities? And the reason I ask is, has there been a concerted effort by China of sort of psychological warfare, cutting cables, practicing blockades, that sort of thing? Is that the possibility, or you think this is for real? We're going to get ready.
I mean, they didn't seem to try very hard for us not to see them. I mean, China recently passed a law, I guess. There's a new directive, essentially, that promises punishment to Chinese citizens that publish military information on social media. Some people think it's a reaction to the J-36 fighter reveal. I think it was probably in the works a lot longer than that. So it's interesting to see these on social media, which is where the community got those images. So what does that mean? Does it mean somebody didn't get the memo about not putting this stuff on the internet? Or is it a deliberate thing that the Chinese censors went ahead and let that stuff get out? Now, they have been removed from social media, apparently, since then. So it's really hard to tell for sure. I mean, they didn't try super hard to keep them concealed. They could have built them in, they were being built in open graving box, you could see on satellite imagery. So they weren't trying that hard to keep them hidden. Like, you know, they built submarines inside assembly halls and you don't see them until they're launched. So they weren't trying super hard to keep them concealed. So is there some message in there? Maybe. I mean, I certainly think that even if China someday decides to use coercive measures against Taiwan that aren't planned to include an invasion, I think a credible threat in an invasion makes things like a blockade or a missile bombardment much more potent than if there's no credible threat of invasion.
So we in America like to tell ourselves that, you know, we innovate things and China copies us. And this seems to flip that on its head. So China has innovated this, and we can't even build a pier off of Gaza to drive some things off, right? Why isn't America doing things like this now?
Well, I mean, you know, this specific capability, we don't have a real need for it. I think for the United States, like, you know, we're not planning to invade somewhere like Taiwan. And generally, when we have conducted military operations like invasions of places like Iraq and Afghanistan, we've been able to do so from relative sanctuary. You know, we were operating from countries next door, like Saudi Arabia, where we had secure port facilities, total air superiority, and could take the time to just use normal port facilities to move them in. So some of this is, you know, necessity is the mother of invention here in this case, China is the country in the world right now that is working on the ability to carry out a contested, very large scale invasion. I mean, they're the only ones on the planet by sea. They're the only ones on the planet that do that or that are working on that. And part of that is to take advantage of their very large Navy and their ability to, and a very large merchant marine. So I think what people sometimes miss, I think, is that people think of oceans and like the Taiwan Strait as a moat, as a boundary. You have to remember that if your adversary has sea control and sufficient sea lift, that's not a moat. It's a highway that comes straight to your shores. And, you know, ask the Germans in World War II, ask the Japanese in World War II. So I think they're leveraging the ability to take advantage of that. I 100% agree, Ray, that people have been saying for some time that the Chinese just copy things. And for a while, that was mostly true, but it is not true anymore. We're now seeing platforms, the Renhai Cruiser, the new J-36 fighter, these things, you know, anti-ship ballistic missiles, hypersonic glide vehicles, they are not copying anything. This is stuff that is more advanced in many cases and more innovative in some ways than anything that the West is building.
All right, so let's marry up the question of U.S. capabilities in construction and who controls the seas. And that gets to your old job as a submariner. And part of that actually was overseeing for the Navy the construction of Columbia-class nuclear subs. We are now looking at a shortfall in Virginia-class attack subs, which we have promised to Australia as part of our AUKUS agreement. It's a real concern. We're only producing 1.2 a year, and we need many more, at least two or three. From your experience, what is the problem getting to there? Is it manageable? What do we need to do?
Well, I think it's certainly a challenge. So first of all, not to take too much credit for the role that I had, I was the requirements officer. I was on the Navy staff. So I was not the program manager of the Columbia class. I was just the guy on the Navy staff who was responsible for making sure that kind of in the middle of everything, that the acquisition program was building what we needed built. And that we, you know, I helped get the money from Congress, et cetera. So, but that said, many of the challenges that we, you know, that you could see coming in terms of the, you know, Columbia construction were just a sheer volume of work that the submarine industrial base was going to have to deal with. I put a chart on Twitter a few months ago that I received from the submarine industrial, I forget exactly what it was, but the industrial base folks, that showed that the volume of tonnage that our submarine industrial base is going to have to build in the coming years is it's as big as it ever was during the Cold War. It's not even more. So unfortunately, there was a number of years after the end of the Cold War where we basically didn't buy any new submarines for a while, and the industrial base atrophied, and that wave is still being worked through to this day, the capabilities that were lost. So what do we need to do? Well, I mean, we need to make investments, and the investments are happening. To be clear, there's a great deal of action by really smart submariners and people that are working this problem, and with investment from Australia to help beef up our industrial base, to help support the extra hulls that we need, that we have committed to provide to them. So there's a lot of work in progress to try to make that problem better. It's going to take more money. I mean, there's no doubt about it. There are recent significant cost increases that the Congress is informed of that they didn't really enjoy hearing about the way they heard about them, apparently. But that's reality. I mean, you know, it's post-COVID supply chain, it's the industrial-based challenges, I don't know what's going to happen with tariffs, if the steel pricing are going to increase, or that could make these even more expensive. Hard to say at this point. So there's real challenges there. The people that I know, I've been getting on briefs and heard of the things they're working on. I think they're going down the right road. I think a full year continuing resolution this year doesn't help for sure. That's one thing I find to be very frustrating. You have, for example, China, their defense budget went up by 7.2% last year or for 2025. It's the official budget, which I don't believe. But they say 7.2%. Ours, full year continuing resolution, basically 0%, essentially a cut when you account for inflation. Completely unacceptable and utter failure to me on the part of our Congress and the administration. So, not good to see that doesn't help either. So lots of challenges there, lots of things being done to try to deal with it. I don't see any other options, to be honest. You know, like I recently saw a proposal, which I warned Rock by a retired Australian submariner, proposing that Australia go back to the French for nuclear submarines. There's a number of reasons why I think that's a very bad idea. One of which being that the diesel electric submarine program that they were working on with the Australians was going to cost $4.5 billion US dollars per diesel electric submarine, which was an astounding amount of money. That's acquisition cost. That's more than Virginia class submarines. So I don't know how they think they're going to go back, and how this proposal, the writer thinks they're going to be able to go back and get French nuclear submarines cheaper. And in any case, I think this is the only way we have at this point with the Australians.
So, Tom, you also have been working on air bases. You recently published with Timothy Walton a piece for the Hudson Institute called Concrete Sky, Airbase Hardening in the Western Pacific. And in it, you essentially say, you know, we need to get about the business of taking those air bases that are, for example, near China, and maybe even some that are a lot farther away from China, and harden them for the future. So we recently had the Pacific Air Force's commander, General Schneider, on the program, and he talked about the concept of agile combat employment, essentially moving the planes around so that they can avoid being targets. But why is that not enough? Why do we need to go out and actually spend money on hardening air bases?
So in terms of why it's not enough, so one thing we're seeing is a really very dramatic asymmetry that has happened, that has developed in the Western Pacific in terms of airbase survivability. This project started with us looking at, you know, that there were, you would see on Twitter individual people posting images and imagery of Chinese airbases that are being improved and hardened and, you know, built new shelters and whatnot. So the first part of this effort was, is this a systematic thing? Is this happening in a lot of places in China? And so to get that in a granular way, we went and looked at imagery from about 10 years ago of every Chinese airbase that we could find the existence of. So it's well over 100 airbases. And then look now and see on imagery and measure what's the ramp areas, number of runways, count the number of what looks like hardened shelters, what looks like the number of non-hardened shelters. And what we found was a very large scale and systematic effort on China's part to harden its airbases. So they have constructed over the last decade, 400 or so hardened aircraft shelters within 1,000 nautical miles of Taiwan. They'd built more than 1,000 non-hardened shelters where you could potentially, they could move aircraft in and you wouldn't see it because they're sheltered. It added a lot, entirely new air bases, lots of new runways. So that was interesting to, oh my goodness, they're really making a dedicated effort to significantly increase the survivability of their air bases, not just across from Taiwan, but across China. So then we went to go like, well, what are we doing, right? There's been awareness in defense circles for some time now of the rapidly increasing threat to U.S. bases. What are we doing about it? Well, one of the things that, as you mentioned, Ray, is dispersal. Agile combat employment, they call it, right? So this is, we're going to provide more targets. We're going to be agile, move around. But if you look at what experts have recommended for decades now, and to be clear, like, this is not a newly discovered problem. So there were research from the CFBA and other think tanks that around the turn of the millennium said, hey, you know, someday some U.S. adversary might combine ballistic missiles, precision guidance, and some munitions, and they might be able to hold at significant risk our air bases in the region. Well, what do you know? That threat is here now in the form of the DF-21C, the DF-26, the DF-27, and in very large numbers. So some of the suggestions over the years have been, one thing to do is dispersal. Yeah, disperse our forces either on a base, like build more ramp area, or to multiple bases. That's one thing you can do. But also, these experts, in many cases, Project Air Force experts for the RAN, also clearly recommend improvements of survivability to include hardening, pouring concrete. So more hardened shelters, hardening of infrastructure, tanks, etc. And that's something we have certainly done before. During the Vietnam War, we built like over 1,000 hardened aircraft shelters within a matter of a few years as part of the Concrete Sky program. That's what it was called, which as soon as I read that, so that's got to be the name for the study. Concrete Sky, beautiful. We don't seem to be doing it now. So we, from what we could tell in our research, just looking at the bases, the United States has built a grand total of 22 hardened aircraft shelters over the last decade. 20 of them are in South Korea and may not even be available in the event of a U.S.-China conflict, depending on what South Korea does. Two are way up in northern China, way up in northern Japan. So I find our level degree of farming at our bases unacceptable. If you look at the number of weapons required to hit our aircraft on places like Adena and Guam, the submunitions can cover huge areas where you can have multiple aircraft taken out by a single missile. In fact, one of those studies from back in 1999, 2000, with some assumptions they made, you can see literally dozens of U.S. fighter aircraft parked at standard intervals, taken out by a single missile, like more than 50 or 60 by one missile. So, you know, I get it that the Air Force leadership doesn't seem to be, at least thus far, very interested in pardoning, but yeah, I disagree. You know, I understand they've got other bills to pay and other things to worry about. I am concerned, and you know, we as authors of the report were concerned that just the scale of the threat that China can present, and the comprehensiveness of its ISR, its targeting capabilities in the future, it just doesn't seem like we're going to be able to disperse our way out of that problem. It's going to take more than that.
So the picture you're painting, Tom, is not real pretty, because our aircraft are a threat. The Chinese Navy is expanding and is now significantly larger than ours, certainly larger than ours in the Asia Pacific. And Chinese capabilities for an actual invasion is only growing. So if you're the Taiwan president, what do you do? You mentioned mines. Are there other things they can do without depending on the hope that U.S. nuclear threat will be sufficient?
I mean, I think they just have to get a lot more serious about their defense a lot faster. I mean, you know, we see other countries like Israel that have been threatened by their neighbors for years, or our Cold War allies during the Cold War, when you had Soviet armies not too far away. You just see a much more robust application of national resource and will to the problem. I mean, they need to spend more. They need to significantly increase the resources they are putting into their own defense. They need to make military service a much bigger thing. I mean, I understand they're making some changes, but I don't think it's enough, quickly enough. I just would expect to see far more urgent action on the part of Taiwan. Is this insurmountable? No, it's of course not. I mean, like, it's the good news is that amphibious assaults are really, really hard. I mean, they are one of the most challenging types of military operations to pull off. So you only got to make it a little bit hard for them because what you want is for China to not be sure that it's going to work. Like a lot of times you'll see people say, well, the cost would be too high. They'd never try it. Well, okay. That didn't stop the Kaiser from going across the border in 1914. The potential cost to Russia didn't stop Putin from going across the border in 2024. We have seen a clear willingness on Xi Jinping's part to inflict economic costs on his own people. In the pursuit of party supremacy and party security. So this idea that we're going to deter them through costs, you have to make them uncertain that it's going to work. And so Taiwan needs to take concrete action, and so do we, for that matter, such that China's leaders in 2027 look at the situation and say, you know, we're not sure this is going to work. They put in place command and control that is buried and mobile, and we don't know if we're going to take it out. They've got aircraft that don't need the airfields that we've have targeted. They've got dozens of trucks with anti-ship cruise missiles that are dispersed on a day-to-day basis, so we can't catch them by surprise. The U.S. Air Force is dispersed and the Japanese ASDF are dispersed to dozens of civilian air bases on a day-to-day basis. We're never going to catch them all. That sort of thing. You know, by the way, when we weren't looking, Taiwan laid minefields while we weren't paying attention. Or they went out and laid minefields when we weren't ready for it. Like, that's the way I see you do it. Like, I think the PLA is, if they have an operation that they can plan for months and months ahead of time that they're going to just execute lockstep, that's the kind of thing they're good at. I don't think they'd be necessarily so good at reacting. So if Taiwan makes an aggressive move to lay these minefields because of the threat they're under, when the Chinese aren't expecting it, they might be able to get away with it. So those are the kind of things that I would like to see happen over the next couple of years on an urgent basis that makes Xi Jinping in 2027 say, you know, I'm not sure we can do this.
What would a successful conquest of Taiwan generate in the Indo-Pacific? What would happen to America's position? What would happen to America's allies in the region? How would it change the calculus militarily and politically if China was able to take Taiwan?
So I've seen a lot of debate from people that I respect on both sides of this argument. Some that say that it changes everything, and some that say that it doesn't change as much as people think. I think it would be pretty significant. In part, it may matter in terms of how it happens. I mean, so if the U.S. just kind of stands aside and doesn't doesn't stop China, it may be very bad for U.S. alliance credibility, but the U.S. military will remain intact. And that latent power may still be there. And in terms of U.S. ability and credibility, from in terms of combat effectiveness, if the U.S. gets, if we get clobbered in the region and suffer the kind of losses that we might, and suffer the loss of credibility as being shown that we end up able to win, that might be even worse. Not hard to say for sure. What would be definitely true is that if China does take Taiwan, for one thing, they would have open access to the wider Pacific Ocean. They know that the Chinese Navy is still to some degree hemmed in by the first island chain, but they have to penetrate it to get to the open Pacific and also to get out into the Indian Ocean. And if they control Taiwan, well, for one thing, they would have deep water ports right on the Philippine Sea, and now would have direct access. They would now pierce the first island chain. I think that's significant. Like there's debate about how much does it matter if the basin's removed a few hundred miles east. I think direct access to the open Pacific, certainly from an undersea warfare perspective, matters. As for the chip industry and being able to control that and maybe destroy it, I mean, you know, power is a relative thing. So if we're hurt more than they are by Taiwan's industry being affected, then, you know, who knows how they would feel about that. But I think soon that it would be very, very bad as far as strategic position in the Western Pacific.
So just picking it out a little bit, aren't the islands that China built in the South China Sea already giving them some degree of access and control over that part of the world?
It gives them access and a degree of control over the approaches to their ports. I would say that to Shanghai, to the Pearl River Delta. I don't think it's quite the same as controlling the East Taiwan ports, because even those ports and or even those bases. Well, first of all, those basins in the Western Pacific aren't. In the South China Sea, they aren't connected to anything. There's no rail lines going to them. I mean, they are military bases, but there's no more robust civilian infrastructure that supports them like I think bases in eastern Taiwan would. And even if even with those bases, that doesn't help them get their submarine forces out into the deep water. They have to go through the Bashi Channel and the Luzon Strait to get into the open Pacific. So that doesn't help them in that regard. There is a bit of a choke point there to get into the Philippine Sea. Once China's got undersea forces with unimpeded access in the Philippine Sea, now they're a much larger threat to Japan's sea lines of communication. And the thing we have to remember is that all of our allies in the Indo-Pacific are essentially island nations, even South Korea. South Korea's got oceans on three sides and Kim Jong-un on to the north. So all the rest of them are essentially island nations. They're all dependent upon maritime transport for their survival as modern economies. And once China has greater access to those sea lanes, they can threaten them in a way that they might not be able to right now.
All right, Tom, we'll get you out of here on this. The president a couple of weeks ago announced that he is forming an Office of Shipbuilding. So if you were suddenly thrust into the position of having to run this Office of Shipbuilding, what would be at the top of your agenda?
I mean, I think it has to start with leveling the playing field. You know, there was a recent report CSIS released called Ship Wars, as opposed to Chip Wars. And it is a really good, really great report on the status of the rise of China's dual purpose civil military shipbuilding and how they kind of got where they are, which is by far the world's largest shipbuilders in the history of humanity. They had a statistic even I had never heard that a single Chinese shipyard in 2024 built more tonnage of commercial shipping than all of the U.S. shipyards since World War II combined, which that should help to give some scale of just how big their shipbuilding industry is. Are we going to match that? Of course, we're not going to get to anything quite that scale. But I think that we should be taking action to try to at least start to level that playing field. And we have to understand, like, these Chinese shipbuilding industries are not normal companies. They're state-owned. They are CCP-run. If you look at the leadership structures of all of them, they're all run by, they have Communist Party committees. They are arms of the CCP. And as such, to let them have a commercial the enormous commercial advantage they have. And this, what this report talked about was that something like 46% of the resources those companies have has been through subsidies. Like they're super heavily subsidized over time. So I would try to level that playing field. I would try to put some requirements in the shipping industries that we start to build U.S. ships, or at least buy U.S. ships, to we have some at least baseline, you know, self-sustaining level of capability. I would tell you the other thing I would be doing is looking really hard at how much longer do we allow, for example, Costco ships into our ports.
Costco being the Chinese shipping company.
It is. It's the largest Chinese shipping company. Why do I worry about this? Well, if they're also a PLA associated company, their ferries routinely take part in PLA exercises. They were recently designated by the Department of Defense as a Chinese military company. But we have these container ships with thousands of containers on board routinely coming into our ports, near our ships, near our naval bases. I mean, if China really does want to strike first and strike by surprise, I shudder at the thought of what they could do with all that shipping in our ports, whether it's containerized missiles or quadcopters or dropping mines on the way out or whatever. And I get it that there could be commercial disruption from that, but I think it's kind of crazy that we let this, clearly an arm of the PLA and the CCP, be operating at our ports all the time. Because I can tell you for sure, from my experience, if a Chinese naval vessel pulls into port with your ship as a commanding officer, there are all kinds of things you have to do to make sure they don't hear your sound signature, to make sure you're not transmitting near them so they're not collecting on it. But I don't think anybody's paying attention to all these other platforms, which could be used for intelligence collection or who knows what else.
We're going to charge them $1.5 million to dock at our port, so that'll take care of it.
We'll see. Yeah. Anyway, I mean, it's something, right? It's a perfect note. It's something, though.
All right. Well, Tom Shugart, thanks for joining us. Where can people follow your work, and what are you working on?
So I'm on Twitter, obviously. I talk a lot on Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it these days. I'm the adjunct senior fellow, as you mentioned, with the Center for New American Security, so I write reports with them from time to time. What I'm working on these days, a fair bit of consulting for various organizations that I can't really talk about publicly, but providing my expertise as best I can to help people navigate the very real geopolitical risk that exists today for that certain folks in the business world need to be thinking about.
All right, Tom, you've been a great guest. Thanks so much for sharing your expertise with us today.
Thank you, gentlemen.
And as usual, we are sponsored by Bauer Group Asia, a strategic advisory firm that specializes in the Indo-Pacific. They apply unmatched expertise and experience to help clients navigate the world's most complex and dynamic markets. My co-host, Jim Caruso, is a senior advisor with Bauer Group, and you can find them at their website, bauergroupasia.com.
Well, Ray, that was a sobering discussion.
No.
So, when you were in the military all those years, and you only retired, a couple of years ago, were you aware that our military is in such, we'll call it disrepair, but seemingly unprepared for this challenge?
See, I will say I have learned a lot since then. I was not looking at I was not as focused on the industrial base, really, is what a lot of what we're talking about. And I think that there were some things that I took for granted. Again, I grew up in a military that still described the world like Colossus, right? I mean, I grew up in a military that was, mostly in the post-Cold War period, after the Berlin Wall fell. We had no peer for quite a long time. Our first big, adventure outside of that was the first Gulf War, which of course we walked, it was a cakewalk really for us. So we had this moment, and it takes a long time for for somebody else to come up and threaten us to the extent that China can now, but also to sort of have the realization that there's a lot more to having a military than the iron on the ramp that you see, that, the cool plane that's out there that, is the fifth generation fighter or whatever. There's a lot more that goes into it. And China has been paying a lot of attention to the lot more.
I keep thinking that we are in a series of Sputnik moments. We realize, oh, we're not the biggest, baddest kid in the block. Or a Maginot Line moment when we realize, gee, that thing that worked in World War I really didn't work in World War II. So I guess, are we seeing the sense of urgency from our Department of Defense and politicians to meet the moment?
I mean, I think Tom's answer was clear. Absolutely not, right? I mean, so what is becoming very clear is that China is on a war footing, and we're not, and Taiwan is not, right? So, you know, we are simply, you know, we are sleepwalking into a potential existential event because, you know, make no mistake, war involving a great power with nuclear weapons, what's happening in Ukraine pales in comparison from what could be true in the Western Pacific. And, you know, the main way to keep that from happening is to deter it. And to deter aggression, your adversary must believe two things, that you are both willing and able to inflict serious harm on them. And our willingness is clearly under question these days, and our ability is increasingly under question these days, and that should concern everybody in that broken town called Washington, D.C. right now.
I think back to our discussion with now Undersecretary of Policy at Defense Department, Elbridge Colby, where he said, basically, we can't support two fronts. No. So we're choosing Asia. It's up to Europe to defend Europe. And by golly, they seem to now be getting the message, and Germany's voted for a massive increase in their defense spending, as have other Europeans. So maybe it's a sea change.
Yeah. Of course, you know, we actually are involved in military action today, and it's not in the Indo-Pacific, it's back in the Middle East. So there's this great sucking sound that keeps us from really, you know, pivoting. We had our podcast on the failed pivot a while ago. The reason we don't pivot is because there's just things that keep drawing us back to Europe and the Middle East. So, yeah.
I always thought that giant sucking sound was just you, but okay. All right. Your turn for a story to illustrate all this.
All right. So we were talking about amphibious landings. And of course, I'm an Air Force guy. So what do I know about amphibious landings? But what you don't know, Jim Caruso, is I have actually made an amphibious landing in the Philippines. I was not with Douglas MacArthur. He was more of your generation, I think. I just can't resist. It was actually after the eruption of Mount Pinatubo. And my wife and I were evacuated from Clark Air Base to Subic Naval Base first. And then after the eruption from Subic, we were picked up by a Navy ship. You know, they were basically shoving everybody onto the 7th Fleet, right? And so we got onto the USS Roanoke. We spent two nights at sea, sleeping on the deck, because, of course, there aren't beds for refugees on Navy ships. And eventually got to Cebu, and in the morning they brought a landing craft out to move us from the boat to the beach. So I made an amphibious landing. You know, they lowered the front of it, and we walked off onto the beach, and then we're airlifted out from there to Guam.
Did you get your feet wet?
You know what? I think so, but I don't quite remember. One of the things I remember. I have like a couple of really clear memories. One of my favorites was that the USS Roanoke was very proud of the fact that they delivered their first ever baby during the evacuation. So they announced it. You know, it was everybody was clapping for the accomplishment. And then I remember this really cute scene where this little girl was walking around, and it was being basically walked around the deck. You know, of course, you have all these families, right? And families are not ready for this, and they're sleeping on the deck. So the sailors were great. And so there's this big, immense African-American sailor in his dungarees, and he had this little tiny white hand wrapped around his pinky, and he's walking her around the deck. And it was just such a great picture. I wish that somebody could have caught it. But it was just sort of emblematic of the fact that they didn't have much to give us. Again, you know, we're sleeping on the deck, but they gave us what they had, and they were really, really good to us. I became a fan of the Navy on that trip. And it was one of, actually, even though it was very difficult to be in a volcano and a refugee for a little while, it was, I have some pleasant memories from it as well.
Any port in a storm or in a volcano?
Exactly. Well, they had to get us away as far enough away from the volcano so they actually land airplanes, because everything up in Luzon was covered in ash. So, and I think I told that story on a previous podcast, but this particular part of it, the amphibious landing, was one thing I don't think I told before. So anyway, so that was my amphibious landing. Our audience can't see it. Even our YouTube audience can't see it, but our producer Ian has his Navy hat on. So, you know, shout out to the Navy. You can follow Ian on Twitter or X at Ian Ellis Jones. He does some fantastic content that you really should be watching if you're a watcher of political, geopolitical, and military events around the world. If you enjoyed this episode, you want to go back and see some of others. We talked about the one that we did with General Schneider talking about air power in the Indo-Pacific. That was episode 61. In fact, we talked recently, and actually one that we haven't released as of this recording, but we're about to release this week, is one on dark fleets with Sal Mercogliano, in which he also talks about shipping and some of the challenges that we have in shipbuilding. And the reason I bring him up is that Sal has done some fantastic work on YouTube explaining what's going on his channel, what's going on with shipping on YouTube, explaining exactly what these invasion barges are. So you should click over there after you leave and make sure you hit the little bell on your subscribe so that you're subscribed up to us. Go visit Sal's page. Finally, you can follow us on social media. We're on X, we're on LinkedIn, and you can email us indopacificpodcast@gmail.com, indopacificpodcast@gmail.com. And by the way, an emailer was responsible for us having Tom on today, because that was the first person who said, hey, you should really get this guy on. And we were looking for an excuse to do that, and these invasion barges gave us the perfect reason. So thank you to our emailers, and if you have your own suggestions, please send us a note. Finally, thank you, Bauer Group Asia. Please go visit them at their website, bauergroupasia.com. For Jim and Ian, I'm Ray. We're out, and we'll see you next time on Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific.